This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 13th of January 2013 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Weekly is brought to you in association with Tourism Australia. Well, hello, and welcome to the Monocle Weekly, episode 184, with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
On the show today, we'll be meeting former editor of The Economist, Bill Emmett, and Annalisa Piras, the former London correspondent for L'Espresso, to learn why they both feel Italy's scandal-racked political landscape is in dire need of an international wake-up call.
But it's not all bunga bunga parties. We'll also be hearing from author Richard Davenport-Hines about his new take on a very British scandal, the Profumo affair, that tore through UK government in the 1960s.
And we'll be learning how our brains work with Professor Ari Perry, the singing neuropathologist of San Francisco. We'll check whether our minds were in good working order when we made this booking a little later.
That is all to come, plus Tom Edwards to give us next week's news and some great music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. What's that? It's the sound of you turning up on your sledge, Andrew.
Okay. Yes. Well, it's sad. The snow has kind of gone from our lives in the sense that the Samaritan's days seem like a bit way off now.
I wonder if in Tom Edwards' news look ahead, he's going to do the weather, because I see we're going to be experiencing possibly some snow. Maybe we'll have to be a bit further up country. Maybe in Studio 2, Andrew. Studio 1.
It's certainly turned nippy in these parts. And is that a Christmas jumper I see?
Yeah. So, you know, we used to talk about radio knitwear before in the Monocle Weekly. In Monocle Weeklies of times past, we've all had a bit of radio knitwear on. This is a Christmas jumper.
That's a proper, for people listening in, it's a kind of a zip neck.
It's got a zip neck.
Not all the way
down.
There we are.
Bit of sound effect. I've got it halfway down. It's got a sort of leather toggle on the zip, which gives it a sort of very outdoorsy kind of feel. And it's a sort of thick knit, isn't it? I don't know what you call it. I feel almost like I'm armoured as much as...
Yeah, it's checked. It's nice. It's cozy. It's navy.
Embalmed in wool.
Okay, we've done.
You're a little thinner. You've got a little. I've got merino wool fine thing there.
Yeah, it's wrong.
Is it? Are you too cold?
Yeah, it's a bit chilly.
Speak to the powers that be. Probably turn the air conditioning up.
I don't think so. It's illegal.
So we should wish at least from the two of us to our Monocle Weekly listeners a happy new year, right? It's not too late to do that, is it?
No.
It's late, but not too late.
I've been doing it all week. People are very unsure whether they can say happy new year after a couple of days.
I'm still saying it about March the 14th. It's all right. You do get looks, but you just kind of... have a bedraggled stagger and you can get away with it.
Well, saying as you're the person who usually writes happy birthday in someone's leaving card, I think you can still get away with saying happy new year a few weeks after the event. That's a joke that has kind of appealed to you for 6 years.
It never gets old. It's probably got really old about the second time around, but there you go. We can say that. So we'd just like to wish all a Merry Christmas. But first of all, of course, we will welcome, as usual, if not ever, Tom Edwards to give his news roundup. And you're back with the Monocle Weekly. I'm Robert Banner with Andrew Tuck. And sort of a character that's popped out of a snow globe, Tom Edwards has appeared in front of us. Ho, ho, ho. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Hi, Rob. How are you today?
I'm very well. Thank you very much indeed. Happy New Year to you.
Yes, and to you both.
Now, last week was our best of show, so we didn't have any of you on it.
I know.
What do you feel about that?
I feel like we've robbed the listeners of their birthright.
Their birthright.
Yeah. Okay.
So we're going to cut to the chase. You've got a sort of a long list of things there.
Yeah.
Should we rattle through them?
Why not?
Are you going to sort of put your feet up on the desk and do it at a leisurely pace?
I'm all about rattling today.
All right.
This evening, of course, the Golden Globes. It's very much, Hollywood TV movie season, the award season. Golden Globes tonight. I'm slightly disappointed. Britain's very own Ricky Gervais no longer presenting. He's done it the last couple of years.
Yeah.
Courted quite a bit of controversy with some fairly off-colour remarks. But they've gone with the safe option. Well, have they gone with the safe option? Tonight we'll have Tina Fey amongst the presenters. I think she's going to be kind of the main one.
So they've not just got one presenter, they're kind of doing a few.
Exactly. But she's
acts.
Pretty dry-witted. She'll come up with a few few zingers, as I believe they say on that side of the Atlantic.
They do, don't they? Call them zingers.
Yeah, but no,
I thought that was a Burger King. I thought that's something you could buy in Burger King, a zinger. Am I right?
I think it's something like that.
I think there is a flamed burger called a zinger as well.
But is that in KFC? Anyway, sorry, we're getting off the...
That's thing. Many late nights on the way home, Rob.
Sometimes even those places are closed.
amongst the people being honoured will be the celebrated actor and director Jodie Foster, who's receiving the Cecil B. DeMille Award for Lifetime Achievement.
And why not, indeed? I sound like Barry Norman there.
Appropriately enough.
Yeah, appropriately enough. That's a good thing. And, of course, so this is the warm-up to the Oscars, isn't it? It's always,
exactly.
It's always kind of considered the warm-up to the Oscars. But it's normally kind of better films win the Golden Globes, but it's a kind of water-testing kind of thing, isn't it?
Very much so. So we'll see what we can glean from that.
Okay, good.
Now, tomorrow... This is quite interesting. This is about Cuba. Now, the Cuban government is actually issuing a new law from tomorrow, which will mean that Cuban citizens no longer require these complex exit permits they always required for them to travel abroad. It'll be much easier. They'll just need a passport and a simple visa, and they'll be allowed to leave Cuba for as long as 2 years, which previously was always limited to certainly less than a year. I think it was about 10 or 11 months only. Again, another sort of opening up move from Raul Castro. And quite interesting because it's perhaps an acknowledgement finally that, you know, Cuba will be enriched by not just, you know, tourism and inward, you know, investment, if you like, but
going
by allowing their own citizens to bring back some cultural and economic capital back into the country. So I think that's quite an interesting move.
Would you have one staying at your house?
What Cuban?
Cuban. Cuban.
Oh, of course, they're always welcome.
Got a spare room?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
Good. But I was going to say it was interesting because it's interesting. We did a really good story about the Philippines and how dependent they are on their diaspora, just sending home cash from being nurses and doctors and maids all around the world. So you wonder whether the Cubans thinking actually it'd just be good to have some hard currencies coming in from the US and beyond back into the economy rather than trying to keep everyone in when you've got higher levels of unemployment and you don't really have a huge amount of stuff for people to do.
And if you are a Cuban nurse, I'll be at monocle.com. It's fine.
did you hear that? No, did you hear that little lion? It was Tom's tummy rumbling.
Sorry about that.
I wonder what that was.
I always get a little peckish at this time of day. Don't know what's got into me. Easy. Whoa! That was a big
that
one.
Was
there. Sorry.
That was another one.
It was Andrew's dog.
I need to calm myself.
Is in the control room. I thought the dog was sort of speaking to us over the intercom.
No. Maybe that's what it is. It's nothing to do with me. Okay. Of course. Very professional. Shall I move on? Move swiftly.
Yeah, okay.
On.
Cuba.
Let's jump to Thursday. Now, this is a slightly kind of sports oriented story, but it's got an interesting kind of celebrity angle and a kind of an interesting moral question. Lance Armstrong, the celebrated cyclist, is appearing on Thursday on the Oprah Winfrey's show. This has been covered quite a lot in the build-up, but I think it's interesting when he's actually going to appear. There's been a number of athletes or, you know, sort of disgraced people in a number of forms of life who've chosen her show as the kind of forum to make a confession or to do a mea culpa, including the likes of Marion Jones, the sprinter, who famously sort of wept on the show and confessed to Oprah. Lance is going to appear. We don't know exactly what he's going to say, but obviously he's been pursued by the likes of the Sunday Times journalist David Walsh here in the UK. Very aggressively, people accusing him of cheating. He's been stripped of his Tour de France titles. And a lot of his former colleagues within the cycling world think it's a little unfair that he gets this kind of platform where it's all about on his terms.
It's a strange thing, isn't it, I guess, because he was such a huge celebrity that you want to own up to something. It's far more better to do it with the sort of emotional capital of the biggest TV star in America's sofa than in front of a courtroom.
Well, that's it. Or in front of these sort of doping panels of people who actually launched these formal investigations. A lot of his colleagues are very unhappy that he's been given this platform. But it remains to be seen what exactly he'll say. Will he come out fighting, for example?
Apparently he doesn't have any control rights over it. He's given over it all editorial control. So in a way, she can ask anything.
I think it's very interesting. It'll be interesting to see the nature of his appearance, as you say, whether he will have truly signed over or whether they've got some kind of tacit agreement.
When I went out to do the Sam Ritz show, there was a very annoying posh family behind me, and the two sons were talking to each other about 18 and 16, and the 18-year-old was saying to his younger brother, "You can have my Lance Armstrong jacket. I'm not wearing it anymore." How about that?
But in all seriousness, it's really sad. I mean, not only the people who looked up to him as a sportsman, but he did obviously all this philanthropic and charitable work. And the fact that, the person who was the sort of embodiment of all these supposed great sporting and, philanthropic values, if it does turn out that he's kind of confirmed, as many people suspect, to have had some sort of misdeeds along the way. Mm. What a kind of betrayal that is, especially to those charming young people in St. Moritz. I don't know how charming they sounded from there.
Do you know what? We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you for that triple bill of, well, news interest. Golden Globes, Cubans Abroad, and Lance Armstrong on Oprah. We shall have our eyes peeled and our TV sets tuned into all those things. Tom Edwards, as ever, thank you very much for looking into the future.
And thank you to the little tiger too.
You're tuned in to the Monocle Weekly. We'll be back in a second.
Stephen Newland is a seaplane pilot on Queensland's magnificent coastline and is in no doubt that the colourful, dazzling, awe-inspiring Great Barrier Reef is the finest natural wonder in the world.
I'd have to say, especially around this area here, the water and the scenery is just incredible. The Great Barrier Reef just changes every day. It's never the same.
There's nothing like Australia.
Of all the European players facing the persistent malaise of the world economy, be it Germany's newly found leadership role, the UK's well-practiced routine of dancing on the sidelines, or Spain's seemingly caught completely unawares financial sector, it's perhaps Italy, with a debt of over 2 trillion euros and a government poised to welcome back the return of the man who helped them get there, Silvio Berlusconi, who we should all be most concerned about.
Our first guest today, Italian journalist Annalisa Piras and former editor of The Economist Bill Emmett, know Italy's problems only too well, with the former once being London correspondent for Italian newsweekly L'Espresso and the latter having published a book, Good Italy, Bad Italy, lamenting what they both see as a catastrophic decline in the nation's economic, political and moral fabric over the past two decades. The pair have now made a new documentary, Girlfriend in a Coma, to try and highlight Italy's slide. They'll be joining us in the studio after we hear a short clip from the film.
Girlfriend in a coma, I know, it's really serious.
It all began in 2001 when I was editor of The Economist. We looked at Italy and we were shocked. Corruption, private power, media domination. Our precious capitalism was destroying something even more precious. Democracy. On our cover, we were a trifle provocative about Silvio Berlusconi. He sued us for libel and said we were communists. His proof that I look like Lenin. We won the legal cases. He won two more elections. Western capitalism needs some revolutionary ideas if it is to regain our trust. I vote for the old ones that formed Italy's greatest family firms. Passion, innovation, social responsibility.
Well, Bill and Annalisa, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. The film looks fascinating. I wanted to begin with a very simple fact which is thrown up by the film, that a million Italians have left Italy in a decade. And I wondered, when you look at Italy, people voting with their feet, do you think this is one of the clearest examples of what the malaise is for a country? This is a country that can't keep its young, where people feel that they have no reason to invest their lives in the country anymore.
I think it's a sign of a lack of opportunity and of a country that has forgotten about what made itself strong, which was the creativity of the young, the openness to new ideas, the sense of meritocracy that was there when Italy was the champion emerging economy of Europe in the 1950s and 1960s, but Italy's closed its doors, and so the young, who should be the force of the future, the force for the new Italy, are deciding their opportunities are better in London or Paris or New York or Berlin.
And Lisa, we heard in Bill's amusing voiceover in the clip there from the film that he was sued for looking like Lenin by Berlusconi. Is this part of the problem? We find in 2013 the image of Italy and the image of Berlusconi almost impossible to differentiate from each other. And looking at clips from the film, there's lots of kind of dancing girls on TV shows. This was the kind of thing that was brought in by Berlusconi's kind of media empire, wasn't it? How linked is Berlusconi and the idea of power itself now in the Italian mindset?
Well, very sadly, they are very linked, because this is a man who has dominated politics for the past 20 years in Italy. And he has not only dominated politics, because he has imposed a sort of cultural model through his medias, through his football teams, through a very pervasive presence in all aspects of society. And I must say that there is a big number of people that still like him very much. He has managed to embody a cultural model in Italy that chimes very well with a part of the population, and this is not going to change rapidly.
I was just going to ask about the idea of Italy's kind of the modernity of it and the sort of contemporary nature of Italy. And we see it as it's Catholic and it's quite conservative, possibly therefore the small c. But the creative element of it that doesn't tend to be borne out by Italian media, is that what's missing? Is it the creative stuff? Is it that's the message that's not getting across?
Well, creativity to be developed needs freedom and needs a dynamic environment, which are both lacking in Italy, which has become a country in many ways ruled by the old. So this is part of the reasons why so many young people are leaving Italy, because they feel really that they cannot breathe in Italy. And in our film, we have interviewed several artists who really passionately love Italy, but think that they cannot survive there. They cannot really have any kind of opportunity to express their creativity. And this is very sad, of course, because a country that leaves the most creative and the most talented is a country destined to extinction, to self-destruction.
She can't mention this, but Annalisa, of course, herself left Italy in the year that Berlusconi came to politics for the first time.
Right.
I think the point might be connected.
Yes.
Bill, I wanted to ask you on the same Berlusconi point, and Rob hinted at it there, but how do you hold together these two things which are touched on in your film? There is this world of Berlusconi, you know, that in any other country he would have been run out of power long, long, long time ago, yet somehow the electorate have gone back to him again and again. Yet you also have, as Rob was saying, this other side where the church is so powerful and still this incredibly controlling influence in Italy and very conservative. And you have, you know, quirks of Italian society, like, you know, even today, young guys not moving out from their families until they're married and all these kind of very conservative things. How do these two worlds stick together? Do you think they're two opposing worlds, or do you think it's all part of this same slightly peculiar country that we think we know from the outside?
Well, I think a wonderful thing about Italy is that it is peculiar. That's what makes it interesting. That's why I've written a book about it and made a film about it. So I don't want to condemn its peculiarity. Second, Berlusconi, let's not forget, he never won a majority of the votes in Italy. He's never personally got more than about 30% of the votes, actually. He's always done alliances. He has been brilliant at building that and getting that percent of the votes. Fortunately, now he's at less than around 15% in the polls. But then he's used money and power to build coalitions. And the biggest coalition he built was with the church. And why did the church go with Berlusconi, a thrice divorced or twice divorced man who consorts with minors and behaves in an immoral way? Money. Because the church wanted tax privileges, and he gave them to them. And the church wanted protecting from modernity in the form of legalized gay marriage, in vitro fertilization, all sorts of bioethical reforms that would have come in other Western European countries. So the conservative and the selfish and the power politics blend together to produce the picture that we've seen, sadly, in recent years in Italy.
And I wondered how much, Bill, you thought it was. We always kind of feel that there's a sense that also Italy has that sense that it's still getting over losing its empire as well, 2,000 years later. There is that strange sense. There's a strut, there's an attractive strut to Italy and to Italians that maybe is still a bit of a hangover, right?
Well, there is both positive and negative in that. I mean, there is
an attractive strut.
There's an attractive strut which says a certain form of cultural superiority, which is both about the Roman Empire and about the Renaissance. Mm. I'm just reading the wonderful Wolf Hall by Hilary Mantel. And what's very clear in that book is how much Thomas Cromwell learned from Italy, from his time in Florence, working for bankers and so on. This was the cultural pioneer of its time, and Italians still feel that. On the other side, there's what in our film Umberto Eco says, which is a lack of sense of the state, a lack of the sense of a central government, of a respect for institutions, of respect for the law as well, which comes from a history of invasion. It comes from the fact that the last central state they really had was the Roman Empire. And that then makes it possible for someone like Berlusconi to achieve what he did because actually the institutions are weak. He could steamroller over them.
And I wanted to ask you another question, and this comes out in the film as well, is the important role of women or lack of them. Annalisa, you left when Berlusconi rocked up. These two points, as Bill said, are not unrelated. How come women don't get enough of the slice of the pie in Italy?
This is a very, very important question, and unfortunately I don't have the answer, but certainly it is part of the contemporary tragedy of Italy, how the condition of women has worsened in the past 20 years. According to some European Union statistics, Italy is 30 years behind the European Union average when it comes to women's rights, both in terms of earnings or participation in politics or access to childcare. So how this has been possible? I don't know. Certainly the Berlusconi era has been characterized by a very virulent return of machismo. So Berlusconi has put in politics, in government, in as ministers, his lovers, his mistresses. He has filled the parliament with women who were openly defining themselves as sexual objects. So has this had an impact, an influence on the society and on gender equality? I think so. I think that is undeniably true that the televisions of Berlusconi have bombarded Italians with an image of a woman who was not dignified and was certainly not a professional woman. So I think that there has been a going back in time, very, very marked, that has been in part responsibility of Berlusconi and his media and his kind of machismo culture.
Well, I just add to that that many people would like to change this, but in a system which is not only the machismo culture but also conservative and anti-meritocratic, it's very hard for the talented new generations of women to actually break through. Problems of Italy, illnesses of Italy, work together to prevent change, and so many talented women leave Italy.
Yeah.
Many of the artists and other people that we interviewed for the film are women.
And I was going to ask you, Annalise, when you made this film and you spoke to people, did you feel that there was roughly a broad agreement amongst the kinds of people that you were approaching about what was the cause of the malaise for Italy? And do you think that the film will get a good reception when it's actually played in Italy? Are you interested to see how it travels around the country?
Well, first of all, I don't think that there is clarity in Italy on anything at the moment. The country is in a sort of confused mental state. I mean, when you look at the politics of this electoral campaign that has just started for the elections on the 24th of February, you see clearly that there is a lot of confusion between political parties, between leaders and so on. The people are very confused too. Nobody knows exactly what should be done. There is a lot of lack of clarity on where Italy stands in the world. So there is a very, very weak understanding of globalization and the kind of challenges that we all face in Europe. So, which is why, I mean, it has been possible for Berlusconi to come back into politics and also for other leaders to foster illusions. I mean, there are people that are talking now about withdrawing from the euro, like if it was the solution. Obviously, withdrawing from the euro would be a catastrophe, not only from the point of view of Italians, but for the rest of Europe too. So it is a very, very serious moment because there is confusion. People don't know what is going to happen. And about the second question, what do I expect from this film being presented in Italy? I'm looking forward to it. I'm excited and at the same time a bit worried, because I know that a lot of Italians will not like the image that is reflected in this mirror that me and Bill are putting in front of them, because it's an image that they never see. They never look at themselves as they are seen from abroad. So I hope that it would, for some it would be probably a shock, but I hope that for the majority of people it would be a moment of reflection and a moment of kind of starting to ask themselves more questions about Italy.
I presume you can think of one newspaper group that's probably not going to give you very good reviews.
I wanted to ask as well, like, do you think Italy suffers from its glamorous stereotype? Do you think the idea of great food, beautiful countryside, great design, do you think that people don't take it seriously, somewhere where you can manufacture things, somewhere where there is intellectual rigour, somewhere where there is it is possible to have good governance? Do you know what I mean? Are those things mutually exclusive?
They're certainly not mutually exclusive. I think that they may contribute to some extent to the complacency of Italians who have been very susceptible to the message of people, including Berlusconi, but not sadly only Berlusconi, who've wanted to say everything's fine. You know, you're doing well. What a beautiful country we were in, all this history we have, all the wonderful clothes, the bella figura that we all show. Of course, everything's fine. Don't worry about it. Don't do anything. Don't make any reforms. Don't cut any debt. I think that they may have contributed to that complacency. But there's no reason why these should be incompatible. I mean, Italy used to have the greatest car designers in the world, Pininfarina and Giugiaro. Were pioneers of car design. So that was translating the beauty of creative design to mass manufacturing. Yeah. Now Italy produces fewer cars every year than Britain. Britain. That's amazing.
Bill's raising his eyebrow. If you couldn't get that from his inflection.
And why? Because Italy has kind of given up on mass manufacturing, partly because of a kind of a pervasive anti-capitalist feeling among a lot of particularly the Italian left and the Italian media. They haven't really grown up with globalized capitalism. They don't understand that you need both employers and workers.
And before we go, you should talk us through the title very briefly. It's a great song by the Smiths, Girlfriend in a Coma. Does the analogy stretch to all of Italy?
Well, because when we were thinking about the title, we were thinking about a lot of metaphors to kind of capture this paralysis that has afflicted Italy in the past 20 years. And I had done a documentary for the BBC a couple of years ago, which was called The Italian Patient, that was trying to capture this sense of a disease gripping this country. And Bill had done a book called The Bad Italy and Good Italy. And when we looked at Italy, we thought that actually the disease was not really the best metaphor, but it was more a kind of paralysis, a kind of sleep. And we thought about Sleeping Beauty, and then we said, no, actually,
this beauty, contemporize it.
This beauty is not asleep. She's definitely in a coma.
It's going to take more than a handsome prince to wake her up.
Well, the film is Girlfriend in a Coma. It is by Bill Emmett and Annalisa Piras. Thank you very both for coming into The Weekly. And on the subject of good Italy, bad Italy, now we're going to hear something great from Italy. This is Aura, which aptly roughly translates as the here and the now, from Italian singer-songwriter Jovanotti.
Dicono che è vero che quando si muore poi non ci si vede più. Dicono che è vero che ogni grande amore naufraga la sera davanti alla TV. Dicono che è vero che ad ogni speranza corrisponde stessa quantità di delusione. Dicono che è vero, sì, ma anche fosse vero, non sarebbe giustificazione per non farlo più.
per non farlo più.
That was Jovanotti with Aura, and you are listening to Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck. We'll be looking back at a salacious British scandal of our very own after this.
Stephen Newland is a seaplane pilot on Queensland's magnificent coastline and is in no doubt that the colourful, dazzling, awe-inspiring Great Barrier Reef is the finest natural wonder in the world.
I'd have to say, especially around this area here, the water and the scenery is just incredible. The Great Barrier Reef just changes every day. It's never the same.
There's nothing like Australia.
In fussily conservative early 1960s Britain, the political establishment was rocked by a sex scandal involving glamour, espionage, a suicide, and more than a little alleged sexing up of the facts too. The Profumo affair that arose from Conservative MP John Profumo's relationship with model Christine Keeler, reputedly also the mistress of a Soviet spy, led to accusations of leaked intelligence and a media circus that saw Prime Minister Harold Macmillan resign within months.
It's a story that's been pored over for more than 50 years, yet our next guest is finding new things to say about it. Richard Davenport-Hines' new book, An English Affair, Sex, Class and Power in the Age of Profumo, sheds revealing light on the scandal and demonstrates that the UK's media itself had a heavy hand in how the events played out. And he joins us now in the studio. Richard, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Hi.
Now, we said that in the introduction. It's a much storied story, right? How did you find? Is it new evidence that you found, or a particular way of putting a spin on the story?
Yeah, well, the story as it came out in '63 was controlled by the police in particular, who gave a very slanted and indeed dishonest version of events. And newspapers keep regurgitating that version of what happened, which has scapegoats and victims, and exaggerates a great deal in a fairly nasty way. So I wanted to set out exactly what happened in quite a clear way.
So it was the newspapers kind of towing the police line rather than doing what they do. If best, then they do it very well, finding new evidence themselves.
Well, two things happened. The Metropolitan Police were asked by the Home Office to investigate this guy, Stephen Ward, who was an osteopath who had introduced the War Minister, Jack Profumo, to Christine Keeler. And they had to find a crime to pin on him. They interviewed about 130 witnesses and put a lot of pressure on them about the story they want, the evidence they wanted to gather, and interviewed people early hours of the morning and arrested them on ridiculous charges in order to get them to say that they wanted. And Stephen Ward was eventually put on trial in an incredible stunt case, and he committed suicide just before the jury came to its verdict.
When this happens, it happens, you know, at a cusp of Britain changing in many ways about how it thought about sex. Do you think if this had happened even 5 years later, the outcome would have been different? Is it a really kind of strange period? It's in your book, you talk about the setting of this story, which is in a London which only 5 years before was still shaking off the aftermath of war. And it was a period of change for the city and moral change too. Do you feel that it was a last kind of hangover from something before?
I think the Profumo affair in '63 was really needed by England. It was created by England. It was a last attempt, amongst other things, to repress independent young women's sexuality. The young women in the affair who make their own sexual choices are really stigmatised at the time by the old regime as tarts and prostitutes and worse. The judges and the fuddy-duddies have no idea that women can make their own decisions. I mean, one of the extraordinary things is that Stephen Ward, when he's arrested by the police in June 1963, he's charged with procuring, because under the Sexual Offences Act then, which wasn't abolished until the 1990s, a guy got off with a woman he'd met who was between 16 and 21. Anyone who'd introduced them was guilty of procuring. The idea that any girl over 16 couldn't make up her own mind the judges couldn't understand it, wouldn't accept it.
And it's a massively interesting. It's a proper vortex of influences and different time periods, kind of falling down or swirling down around this bathroom pool, isn't it? It's a strange thing where the Beatles' "Love Me Do" came out in 1963. I think Lady Chatterley's "Lover" was printed for the first time, was being banned 30 years. So it's a very interesting time. And you paint in the pictures that you paint in the book are very graphic. They're kind of like it's a proper portrait of a changing London, of a changing Britain, despite the facts and figures of the case. And there's, look, you had some personal experience with that. Just in the introduction, your father himself had an interesting life, right?
Well, my father kept a girlfriend, if you could call it, that's a euphemistic word for her, in the same block of flats that Christine Keeler lived in 1963. Like, and he used to take me there. I remember it. I remember the building vividly, though I didn't meet Christine Keeler at that time. But I was 9 years old. I got sent to the headmaster to be caned because I'd used this wonderful new word I discovered in an English lesson, orgy. It was wonderful. And we had the headmaster called the whole school together the next week and said, boys are bringing in James Bond novels to the school and they're sadistic. If I catch any boy with one of these novels, I will thrash him. and so England was full of the most incredible sexual tension and confusion and denial and pomposity, which was coming to a boil and which in a way was ended by the Perfumo affair.
But the very key facts of the story as they were told at the time, you seem to kind of prick them all, really, and say that probably most of the things that we think we know about that story were untrue. And as you say, they've lived for a long time. Could you just talk us through the kind of the central accusations that really you have kind of pulled apart? First of all, the idea that Christine Keeler was a prostitute, you say, was probably, she might have been a bit free with herself, but she was certainly not a prostitute.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I feel very strongly having written this book is how incredibly unfairly and unpleasantly Christine Keeler and her then friend Mandy Wise Davis were treated at the time, 18 and 17 year old girls, really bullied by the police and indeed later the security services, and bought and sold by the press. What happened was that Jack Perfumo, who was the Minister of War, met at a swimming pool in the Clifton swimming pool, Lord Astor's home, Christine Keeler at the age of 18. They had a short affair, may have lasted just a couple of weeks, maybe a few months longer. And later the idea developed, very much stimulated by the press, that she'd also been having an affair with an attaché at the Soviet Russian embassy. Now, I don't think this is true. One of the things I argue in the book is that that's an invention. The security services thought it was an invention. All the politicians who made a great big deal out of it knew perfectly well there was no security angle.
Is this something that was stoked up by the newspapers at the time of wanting to, of sort of nuclear secrets being spilt after sex?
Yeah, it was stoked up because, of course, you had the heady mixture of a working class girl, a tough conservative government minister, and the security angle, and a lot of sex and indeed drugs. So the press, for various reasons, were gunning at that time for the Conservative government, and for the first time, the raps were coming. Until then, if a government minister got caught in the bushes in the park with a guardsman, or got caught in a divorce case, there was very little publicity. This is the first moment that publicity really takes
off. And Fleet Street failed to show deference to its ruling classes.
Well, that's partly because they were losing readers very fast because of commercial television coming in, which was much more fun.
I can ask you, what's interesting is, you know, that even then, as the world changed through the coming decades, these characters, they found it impossible to shake off that moment from their lives. And they were, you know, condemned in a sense, you know, forever. You know, Profumo, it was, you know, is he living, you know, a moral life now? He was in the spotlight in a subtle way ever again.
Yeah, I mean, he lived into his late 80s, and every time he walked into a room, the voices fell and people looked at him. Everyone knew who he was, and his name had instant name recognition. Christine Keeler, his life is really damaged by what happens, and I think has been very harshly and unhappily treated by events since Mandy Weiss Davis, whom I've met and is a really special, superb sort of person, picked herself up from it and is actually quite a formidable character who's not been permanently damaged by it. They're still very angry about some things that happened.
But what's extraordinary is that they haven't been allowed to update themselves in the public consciousness in a way. That's the strange thing, is, you know, that our morals have changed, and, you know, if this scandal happened now, nothing would be thought of it. It's commonplace for, you know, a 17-year-old to sleep with someone who's older. It doesn't seem that extraordinary. But now we still don't let them change who they were, even in our minds about those events. We've frozen them in some terrifying way.
Yeah, well, that's partly, of course, that most young journalists now never leave their desk and do all their research online, and regurgitate pretty inaccurate and lazy stories. Some of the press coverage of the Perfume Affair recently, before my book came out, really boring and stale and inaccurate stuff. Yeah. And with about call girls and pimps and the rest of it.
Do you think that's perhaps because we wanted it to be true in a sense? You know, as you said, you hinted there when you were at school about the James Bond novels. I wonder whether we quite liked the idea of this espionage story in a way that it was too good to give up.
Yeah, the espionage story, which I think is pretty bogus, is what made it one in 63, and which still has the oomph now. What's also changed is that 50 years ago, most people had fairly bad sex. They liked to read and think about people having good sex, but then afterwards they wanted them punished and humiliated, and that's more or less gone.
And I wondered if it is, do people keep coming back to it because it was such a watershed moment? It was a difference between Edwardian society and kind of a bit of the swinging 60s and a bit of the prurience that went with it.
Yeah, I think people go back to it because it satisfied an innate cruelty. I mean, a lot of people got hurt, and Stephen Ward himself is driven to suicide after being arrested and given the most appalling show trial. It was very, I mean, I remember as a child the pictures of him in his coma being taken out from the flat where he'd taken his overdose. And it was a very London story. Everything happened either in Marylebone or in Mayfair or a little bit in Notting Hill Gate. And this was a moment, and the West of England was really frightened of how corrupt and how sexually imaginative and how subversive London was. So it was an anti-London story very much.
Well, the book is An English Affair, Sex, Class and Power in the Age of Profumo by Richard Davenport Hines. We say thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, we'll be meeting a singer from San Francisco with a difference.
And if you're wondering what that was, it was the output of the University of California, San Francisco's Professor Ari Perry.
Perry is an authority on the workings of the nervous system and neuropathology. He claims that the same memorable songs we used to teach children can be used to educate medical students too, in learning about some of the most complex and delicate medical issues. And Ari joins us now on the line from San Francisco. A very warm welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you.
And good to hear you in such fine voice as well. It's nice to hear that the worlds of neuropathology and songwriting are not mutually exclusive.
Not in this part of the world, I guess.
Now, where on earth did the... I mean, it's genuinely great music. I love that. I love a bit of a flourish. I love a bit of a samba shuffle. Where did the idea come from to put such complex stuff into song?
That started almost exactly 20 years ago when I was a trainee. I was a resident, and we had a weekly conference where the residents presented to the attendings whatever interesting cases were around from the prior week. And one of the weeks, one of the attendings made the comment that she didn't think we were entertaining enough. And I kind of took that as a challenge. So
you begged to differ.
Yeah. So I was kind of, the gauntlet was thrown down. And so the following week, I presented a case of a schwannoma, benign type of nerve sheath tumor. And I presented it like I normally would at the beginning at a multi-headed microscope. And then at the end, I pulled out a guitar and I sang a schwannoma song. And it was a big hit, and everybody walking by the room came in to see what in the world was going on. And so we had a lot of fun. And a few years later, when I was teaching medical students, I thought, well, this is a fun way for people that like this type of approach to learn a few facts. So each year I would write one or two more songs for a while, and eventually I put together a CD recording.
And tell me, what's the kind of trick to doing a good song? Because I would imagine, first of all, that you're probably stymied often because there must be lots of words it's quite hard to find something to rhyme with.
That's exactly right. So usually I try to figure out what are the most awkward terminology phrases that I'd like to put into the song and kind of get a feel for what type of rhythm would fit with that. And sometimes some pre-existing song just kind of comes to mind and fits pretty well. When I started, I usually tried to just write the melody as well, but I'm not really a composer, so it was much easier later on to use pre-existing music.
And I'm sure being a professor of neuropathology and having an amazing knowledge of the workings of the inside of our brains, Ari, is one thing. But do you secretly yearn for stardom? And can that exist alongside the white coat?
Well, you know, if somebody was willing to pay me as much as I make as a physician to do purely music, I would be very tempted, I think, yes.
And where do people get to hear you these days? Are you still singing when you lecture, or do your patients ever hear you burst into song at an inappropriate moment?
No. So, well, first of all, as a pathologist, I rarely speak directly with patients, but occasionally I do, especially nowadays with the Internet. They usually find me in email. But I do use these songs still with our medical students. And it's kind of expanded, and I use it in lectures now fairly frequently with our residents and even sometimes in national and international meetings when I'm invited to talk. I just give them a nice surprise at the end of the lecture with one of these songs. But beyond that, I sing with an 8-man a cappella group here in San Francisco called Mosaic, and that's a lot of fun. I enjoy that quite a bit.
So you've heard of a barbershop quartet. You're kind of like a sort of neuropathologist octet. That's the kind of an amazing musical specificity.
No, actually, one of the other people in the group is a physician. He is an internal medicine physician.
He's a joker.
But all the others are not in medicine. But it's a wide variety of genres that we cover, all the way from classical to pop music.
And just before we go, Ari, I guess the point of this as well is the fact that stuff that rhymes, stuff that has a melody, is, as you obviously know, this gets stuck in our brain a lot easier than anything else, right?
That's true. It's true. Sometimes you can't get it out of your brain even if you want to. But it works pretty well. Some people better than others, I think. You know, some people have really great musical memories, and it's much easier, I think, for them to remember certain facts this way than to just try to brute force memorize things rotely. And I think it sticks longer as well once you do it that way.
Right, Ari, well, people can check out schwannoma. They can Google that. I expect if they type in Ari Perry and schwannoma, they will find that, and they can download that. And possibly it might be the most memorable song of all time if it's doing its job right. For the time being, Ari Perry on the line from San Francisco. Thank you very much for joining us on The Weekly. And that, ladies and gentlemen, was edition 184 of the Monocle Weekly.
Nice guests.
I like that one a lot. It was a broad church, wasn't it?
Yes. And I think it was interesting, the discussion about Italy, because I think the same as you were saying, you that there's, you know, let's be honest, Italians have often a better quality of life than people in many wealthier countries. There's something about, you know, the food and the rhythm of life and the physical surroundings. But it does kind of obscure some bigger truths sometimes.
Yeah, I kind of think it's a thing. It's that strange, the curse of the South. You know, the Latin thing. We all head south. We're all attracted so much to the South. But there's a lot of sort of, with every beautiful fresco, there's a dark truth lurking behind it.
Well, I'm going to be able to find out more because in a couple of hours' time, I'm going to Milan.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, of course you are. That'll be nice.
We have a team in Milan for the menswear shows. And I'm going to the cocktail party for it.
I've done that one before, yeah. It's a pretty tough gig.
Yeah, it's brutal.
It's brutal.
But I will be, I'm going there now to research, to do some backup research on Bill and Annalise's film to find out whether they're telling the truth.
Well, that's very noble of you to do so, Andrew. And, please do have a Negroni for me.
I will do. All in the name of research.
Indeed. Today's show, 184 of them down. Who knows how many to go, Andrew? Billions, possibly. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall. The studio manager was Jack Phillips, aided and abetted by Maisie, Andrew's dog. Thank you very much. We'll be back next week. But until then, it's goodbye from me, Robert Bounds.
And from me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.